Sherman said, "But anyway, this is not the right time for phone calls."
"Not the right place, either. I'll wait until I get back to town, or back to Hope, or Kansas."
Thurman turned and glanced at the gate, turned back. Reacher nodded, said,
"Suddenly you want to check on what numbers I know."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"I think you do."
"Tell me."
"No.
I want some courtesy and respect.
And I want to hit a grand slam at Yankee Stadium. I think both of us are going to be disappointed."
Thurman said,
"Turn out your pockets."
"Worried about those numbers? Maybe I memorized them."
"Turn out your pockets. Make me."
Thurman went still, and his eyes narrowed, and debate crossed his face, the same kind of long-range calculus that Reacher had seen before, in front of the airplane hangar. The long game, 8 moves ahead. Thurman spent a second or two on it, and then he stepped back abruptly and raised his right arm. His plastic sleeve came out into the downpour and made noise. He waved his 2 employees forward. They took 2 long strides and stopped again. The plant foreman kept his hands loose at his sides, and the big guy slapped the wrench in and out of his palm, wet metal on wet skin. Reacher said,
"Not a fair fight."
Thurman said,
"You should have thought about that before."
Reacher said,
"Not fair to them. They've been cutting uranium. They're sick."
"They'll take their chances."
"Like Underwood did?"
"Underwood was a fool. I give them respirators. Underwood was too lazy to keep his on."
"Did these guys wear theirs?"
"They don't work in here. They're perfectly healthy."
Reacher glanced at the foreman, and then at the giant, asked,
"Is that right? You don't work in here?"
Both guys shook their heads. Reacher asked,
"Are you healthy?"
Both guys nodded.
Reacher asked, "You want that state of affairs to last more than the next 2 minutes?"
Both guys smiled and moved a step closer. Vaughn said,
"Just do it, Reacher. Turn out your pockets."
"Still looking out for me?"
"It's 2 against 1, and one of them is the same size as you and the other one is bigger."
2 against 2, Reacher said. "You're here."
"I'm no use. Let's just suck it up and move on."
Reacher shook his head and said,
"What's in my pockets is my business."
The 2 guys took another step. The foreman was on Reacher's right, and the big guy was on his left, both of them close, but not within touching distance. The rain on their clothing was loud. Water was running out of Reacher's hair into his eyes. He said,
"You know, we don't have to do this. We could walk out of here, friends."
The foreman said,
"I don't think so."
"Then you won't walk out of here at all."
"Brave talk."
Reacher said nothing. The foreman glanced across at the big guy. He said,
"Let's do it."
"Get your retaliation in first."
Reacher feinted left toward the giant. The big guy rocked back, surprised, and the foreman rocked forward toward the action. Momentum moving west, a perfect little ballet. Reacher planted his heel very carefully in the mud and jerked the other way, to his right, to the east, and smashed the foreman in the stomach with his elbow. A 500-pound collision. One guy moving left, one guy moving right, an elbow the size of a pineapple moving fast. The stomach is high in the midsection. Behind it lies the celiac plexus, the largest autonomic nerve center in the abdominal cavity, sometimes called the solar plexus. A heavy blow can shut the whole thing down. Result, great pain, and diaphragm spasms. Consequence? A fall to the ground and a desperate struggle to breathe. The foreman went down. He fell face first into a foot-wide rut filled with water. Reacher kicked him in the side to roll him out of it. He didn't want the guy to drown. He stepped over the writhing form into clear air and glanced around through the bright blue light. Thurman had backed off 20 feet. Vaughn was rooted to the spot. The big guy was crouched 8 feet away, holding his wrench like a clean-up hitter waiting on a high fastball. Reacher kept his eyes on the big guy's eyes and said, "Vaughn, step away. This guy's going to start swinging. He could hit you by mistake." But he sensed Vaughn wasn't moving, so he danced away east, dragging the fight with him. The big guy followed, big feet in rubber boots, splashing awkwardly through standing water. Reacher dodged north toward Thurman. Thurman backed off again, keeping his distance. Reacher stopped. The big guy wound up for a swing. The huge wrench slashed horizontal at shoulder height. Reacher stepped back a pace, and the wrench missed, and its wild momentum carried the big guy through a complete circle. Reacher backed off another pace. The big guy followed. Reacher stopped. The big guy swung. Reacher stepped back. 30 acres. Reacher wasn't fast, and he wasn't nimble, but he was a lot more mobile than anyone who outweighed him by 100 pounds, and he had the kind of natural stamina that came from being exactly what he was born to be. He wasn't on the downside of 20 years of weight rooms and steroids, unlike his opponent. The big guy was breathing hard, and every missed swing was jacking his fury and his adrenaline rush all the way up to carelessness. Reacher kept on moving and stopping and dodging and stopping again. Eventually, the big guy learned. With his fifth swing, he aimed for a spot 3 feet behind Reacher's back. Reacher saw it coming in the guy's crazed eyes and dodged the other way, forward. The wrench hissed through empty air, and Reacher rolled around the guy's spinning back and bent his knees and smashed his elbow up into the guy's kidney. Then he stepped away, 2 paces, 3, and stood still and shook his arms loose and rolled his shoulders. The big guy turned. His back looked stiff and his knees were weakening. He charged and swung and missed, and Reacher dodged away, like a bullfight. Except the big guy's IQ was marginally higher than a bull's. After a dozen fruitless swings, he recognized that his tactics were futile. He sent the wrench spinning away into the marshy ground and got ready to charge. Reacher smiled, because by then the damage was done. The guy was panting and staggering a little. The violent exertions and the adrenaline overload had spent him. He was going to lose. He didn't know it, but Reacher knew it. And Thurman knew it. Thurman was hurrying back toward the gate. Hurrying, but slowly. An old man, a heavy coat, awkward footwear, mud on the ground. Reacher called, "Vaughn, don't let him leave. He has to stay here." He saw her move in the corner of his eye, a small, soaked figure darting north. Then he saw the giant launch himself. A crazed lunge across 15 feet of distance. 350 pounds coming on like a train. Reacher felt small and static by comparison. The guy might have been fast on a football field, but he was slow now. His boots churned in the liquid mud. No grip. No traction. He came in on a flailing run, and Reacher feinted left and stepped right and tripped him. The guy splashed down in the water and slid a full yard, and Reacher turned away and was hit in the back by what felt like a truck. He went down hard and got a mouthful of mud and reflexively rolled away and jacked himself back up and dodged and missed the punch from the plant foreman by about 1.5 inches. 2 against 1 again. Inefficient. The foreman launched another big roundhouse swing, and Reacher swatted it away and saw the giant struggling to get up. His hands and knees were scrabbling and sliding in the mud. 50 feet north, Vaughn had hold of Thurman's collar. He was struggling to get free, maybe winning. Then the foreman swung again, and Reacher moved, and the foreman's fist glanced off his shoulder, but not before stinging a bruise from where he had been hit before in the bar, which hurt. Okay, no more, Mr. Nice Guy. Reacher planted his back heel in the mud and leaned in and launched a flurry of heavy punches, a fast, deadly rhythm, 4 blows, right, left, right, left, 1 to the gut, 2 to the jaw, 3 to the head, and 4, a crushing uppercut under the chin, like he was his demented 5-year-old self all over again, but 5 times heavier and 8 times more experienced. The foreman was already on his way down when the uppercut landed. It lifted him back up and then dropped him like the earth had opened up. Reacher spun away and lined up and kicked the scrabbling giant in the head like he was punting a football, instep against ear. The impact pinwheeled the guy's body a whole 2 feet and dropped him back in the mud. The foreman lay still. The giant lay still. Game over. Reacher checked his hands for broken bones and found none. He stood still and got his breathing under control and glanced north through the light. Thurman had broken free of Vaughn's grasp and was heading for the gate again, slipping and sliding and twisting and turning to fend her off. His hat was gone. His hair was wet and wild. Reacher set off in their direction, paused to collect the giant wrench from where it had fallen. He hefted it up and carried it on his shoulder like an axe. He trudged onward, heavily, a slow-motion chase. He caught Vaughn 10 yards from the gate and passed her, and clamped a hand on Thurman's shoulder and pressed downward. The old guy folded up and went down on his knees. Reacher moved onward to the gate. He found the little gray box, flipped the lid, saw the keypad, swung the wrench and smashed it to splinters, hit it again and again. It fell out of its housing in small, broken pieces. A small metal chassis hung up on thin, trailing wires. Reacher chopped downward with the wrench until the wires tore and ruptured and the chassis fell to the ground. Thurman was still on his knees. He said,
What are you doing? Now we can't get out of here.
Wrong, Reacher said. You can't, but we can.
How?
Wait and see.
It's not possible.
Would you have given me the combination?
Never.
So what's the difference? Vaughn said,
Reacher, what the hell is in your pockets?
Lots of things, Reacher said. Things we're going to need. Chapter 71. Reacher trudged through the mud and rolled Thurman's men into what medics called the recovery position. On their sides, arms splayed, necks at a natural angle, one leg straight and the other knee drawn up. No danger of choking. A slight danger of drowning, if the puddles didn't stop filling. The rain was still hard. It thrashed against their slickers and drummed on the sides of their boots. Thurman poked and prodded at the shattered box where the keypad had been. No result. The gates stayed closed. He gave up and slipped and slid back to the center of the hidden area. Reacher and Vaughn fought their way across to the 18-wheeler. It was just standing there, shut down and silent and oblivious. Vaughn said,
You really think this is a bomb?
Reacher said, Don't you?
Thurman was mighty plausible about the gifts for Afghanistan.
He's a preacher. It's his job to be plausible.
What if you're wrong?
What if I'm right?
How much damage could it do?
If they built it right, I wouldn't want to be within 3 miles of it when it goes off.
3 miles?
20 tons of TNT? 20 tons of shrapnel? It won't be pretty.
How do we get out of here?
Where's your truck?
Where we left it. They ambushed me, opened the outer gate, and drove me through the plant in Thurman's SUV. It's parked the other side of the inner gate, which you just made sure will never open again.
No big deal.
You can't climb the wall.
But you can.
They talked for 5 fast minutes about what to do and how to do it. Knives, welds, the average size and thickness of a car's roof panel, canvas straps, knots, trailer hitches, four-wheel drive, low-range gearing. Thurman was pacing aimlessly 100 yards away. They left him there and headed through the mud to the wall. They picked a spot 10 feet left of the gate. Reacher took the 2 switchblades out of his pocket and handed them to Vaughn. Then he stood with his back to the wall, directly underneath the maximum radius of the horizontal cylinder above. Rain sheeted off it and soaked his head and shoulders. He bent down and curled his left palm and made a stirrup. Vaughn lined up directly in front of him, facing him, and put her right foot in the stirrup. He took her weight, and she balanced with her wrists on his shoulders and straightened her leg and boosted herself up. He cupped his right hand under her left foot. She stood upright in his palms, and her weight fell forward, and her belt buckle hit him in the forehead.
"Sorry."
"Nothing we haven't done before," he said, muffled.
"I'm ready," she said.
Reacher was 6 feet 5 inches tall and had long arms. In modest motel rooms, he could put his palms flat on an 8-foot ceiling. Vaughn was about 5 feet 4. Arms raised, she could probably stretch just shy of 7 feet. Total, nearly 15 feet, and the wall was only 14 feet high. He lifted, like starting a bicep curl with a free weights bar loaded with 120 pounds. Easy, except that his hands were turned in at an unnatural angle, and his footing was insecure, and Vaughn wasn't a free weights bar. She wasn't rigid, and she was wobbling and struggling to balance.
"Ready?" he called.
"Wait one."
He felt her weight move in his hands, left to right, right to left, shifting, equalizing, preparing.
"Now go,"
she said. He did 4 things. He boosted her sharply upward, used her momentary weightlessness to shift his hands flat under her shoes, stepped forward half a pace and locked his arms straight. She fell forward and met the bulge of the cylinder with the flats of her forearms. The hollow metal construction boomed once, then again, much delayed.
"Okay,"
he called.
"I'm there,"
she said. He felt her go up on tiptoes in his palms, felt her reach up and straighten her arms. According to his best guess, her hand should right then have been all the way up on the cylinder's top, dead center. He heard the first switchblade pop open. He swiveled his hands a little and gripped her toes for stability. She was going to need it. He moved out another few inches. By then, she should have been resting with her belly against the metal curve. Rain was streaming down all over him. He heard her stab downward with the knife. The wall clanged and boomed.
"Won't go through,"
she called.
"Harder,"
he called back. She stabbed again. Her whole body jerked, and he dodged and danced underneath her, keeping her balanced, like acrobats in a circus. The wall boomed.
"No good!"
"Harder!"
he called. She stabbed again. No boom, just a little metallic clatter, then nothing.
"The blade broke!"
she called. Reacher's arms were starting to ache.
"Try the other one!" he called. "Be precise with the angle, straight downward, okay?"
"The metal is too thick."
"It's not. It's from an old piece of shit Buick, probably. It's like aluminum foil. And that's a good Japanese blade. Hit it hard. Who do you hate?"
"The guy that pulled the trigger on David."
"He's inside the wall. His heart is the other side of the metal."
He heard the second switchblade open. Then there was silence for a second. Then a convulsive jerk through her legs and another dull boom through the metal. A different boom.
It's in! All the way!
Pull on it, he called back. He felt her take her weight on the wooden handle. He felt her twist as she wrapped both fists around it. He felt her feet pull up out of his hands. Then he felt them come back.
It's slicing through, she called. It's cutting the metal.
It will. It'll stop when it hits a weld. He felt it stabilize a second later, called. Where is it?
Right at the top.
Ready?
On three, she called. One, two, three.
She jerked herself upward, and he helped as much as he could, fingertips and tiptoes, and then her weight was gone. He came down in a heap and rolled away in case she was coming down on top of him, but she wasn't. He got to his feet and walked away to get a better angle and saw her lying longitudinally on top of the cylinder, legs spread, both hands wrapped tight around the knife handle. She rested like that for a second and then shifted her weight and slid down the far side of the bulge, slowly at first, then faster, swinging around, still holding tight to the knife handle. He saw her clasped hands at the top of the curve, and then her weight started pulling the blade through the metal, fast at first, where a track was already sliced, and then slower as the blade bit through new metal. It would jam again at the next weld, which he figured was maybe 5 feet down the far side, allowing for the size of a typical car's roof panel, minus a folded flange at both sides for assembly purposes, which would be about a quarter of the way around the cylinder's circumference, which would mean she would be hanging off the wall at full stretch with about 4 feet of clear air under the soles of her shoes. A survivable fall. Probably. He waited what seemed like an awful long time, and then he heard two hard thumps on the outside of the wall. They each sounded twice, once immediately and then again as the sound raced around the hollow circle and came back. He closed his eyes and smiled. Their agreed signal. Out. On her feet. No broken bones.
Impressive, Thurman said, from 10 yards away.
Reacher turned. The old guy was still hatless. His blow-dried waves were ruined. 90 yards beyond him, his two men were still down and inert.
4 minutes, Reacher thought.
Thurman said,
I could do what she did.
In your dreams, Reacher said, she's fit and agile. You're a fat old man. And who's going to boost you up? Real life is not like the movies. Your guys aren't going to wake up and shake their heads and get right to it. They're going to be puking and falling down for a week.
Are you proud of that?
I gave them a choice.
Your lady friend can't open the gate, you know. She doesn't have the combination.
Have faith, Mr. Thurman. A few minutes from now, you're going to see me ascend. Reacher strained to hear sounds from the main compound, but the rain was too loud. It hissed in the puddles and pattered on the mud and clanged hard against the metal of the wall. So he just waited. He took up station 6 feet from the wall and a yard left of where Vaughn had gone over. Thurman backed off and watched. 3 minutes passed, then four. Then, without warning, a long canvas strap snaked up and over the wall, and the free end landed 4 feet to Reacher's right, the kind of thing used for tying down scrap cars to a flatbed trailer. Vaughn had driven Thurman's Tahoe up to the security office and had found a strap of the right length in the pile near the door and had weighted its end by tying it around a scrap of pipe. He pictured her, after the drive back, 20 feet away through the metal, swinging the strap like a cowgirl with a rope, building momentum, letting it go, watching it sail over. Reacher grabbed the strap and freed the pipe and retied the end into a generous 2-foot loop. He wrapped the canvas around his right hand and walked toward the wall, kicked it twice,
and backed off a step and put his foot in the loop and waited. He pictured Vaughn securing the other end to the trailer hitch on Thurman's Tahoe, climbing into the driver's seat, selecting four-wheel drive for maximum traction across the mud, selecting the low-range transfer case for delicate throttle control. He had been insistent about that. He didn't want his arms torn off at the shoulders when she hit the gas. He waited. Then the strap went tight above him and started to quiver. The canvas around his hand wrapped tight. He pushed down into the loop with his sole. He saw the strap pull across the girth of the cylinder. No friction. Wet canvas on painted metal, slick with rain. The canvas stretched a little. Then he felt serious pressure under his foot, and he lifted smoothly into the air. Slowly, maybe 12 inches a second, less than a mile an hour. Idle speed for the Tahoe's big V8. He pictured Vaughn behind the wheel, concentrating hard, her foot like a feather on the pedal.
"Goodbye, Thurman," he said. "Looks like it's you that's getting left behind this time."
Then he looked up and got his left hand on the bulge of the cylinder and pushed back and hauled with his right to stop his wrapped knuckles crushing against the metal. His hips hit the maximum curve, and he unwrapped his hand and hung on and let himself be pulled up to top dead center. Then he dropped the strap and let the loop around his foot pull his legs up sideways, and then he kicked free of the loop and came to rest spread-eagled on his stomach along the top of the wall. He jerked his hips and sent his legs down the far side and squealed his palms across 90 degrees of wet metal and pushed off and fell. 2 long split seconds. He hit the ground and fell on his back and knocked the wind out of himself. He rolled over and forced some air into his lungs and crawled up on his knees. Vaughn had stopped Thurman's Tahoe 20 feet away. Reacher got to his feet and walked over to it and unhooked the strap from the trailer hitch. Then he climbed into the passenger seat and slammed the door.
"Thanks," he said.
"You okay?"
"Fine. You?"
"I feel like I did when I was a kid and I fell out of an apple tree. Scared, but a good scared."
She changed to high-range gearing and took off fast. 2 minutes later, they were at the main vehicle gate. It was standing wide open.
"We should close it," Reacher said.
"Why?"
"To help contain the damage, if I'm right."
"Suppose you're not."
"Maximum of 5 phone calls will prove it, one way or the other."
"How do we close it? They don't seem to have any manual override."
They stopped just outside the gate and got out and walked over to the gray metal box on the wall. Reacher flipped the lid. 1 through 9 plus 0.
"Try 6613, he said.
Vaughn looked blank, but stepped up and raised her index finger, pressed 6613, neat and rapid. There was silence for a second, and then motors whined and the gates started closing. A foot, a second, wheels rumbling along tracks. Vaughn asked,
"How did you know?"
"Most codes are 4 figures, Reacher said. ATM cards, things like that. People are used to 4-figure codes.
"Why those 4 figures?
"Lucky guess. Revelation is the 66th book in the King James Bible. Chapter 1, verse 3 says the time is at hand, which seems to be Thurman's favorite part."
"So we could have gotten out without climbing."
"If we had, they could have, too. I want them in there. So I had to smash the lock."
"Where to now?"
"The hotel in despair. The first phone call is one that you get to make."
Chapter 72 They abandoned Thurman's Tahoe next to where Vaughn's old Chevy was waiting. They transferred between vehicles and bumped through the deserted parking lot and found the road. 3 miles later, they were in downtown despair. It was still raining. The streets
and the sidewalks were dark and wet and completely deserted. The middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere. They threaded through the cross streets and pulled up outside the hotel. The facade was as blank and gloomy as before. The street door was closed but not locked. Inside, the place looked just the same. The empty dining room on the left, the deserted bar on the right, the untended reception desk dead ahead. The register on the desk, the large square leather book, easy to grab, easy to swivel around, easy to open, easy to read. Reacher put his fingertip under the last registered guests, the couple from California, from 7 months previously. He tilted the book so that Vaughn had a clear view of their names and addresses. "Call them in," he said. "And if they're helping the deserters, do whatever your conscience tells you to."
"If?"
"I think they might be into something else." Vaughn made the call from her cell, and they sat in faded armchairs and waited for the call back. Vaughn said,
"Gifts are a perfectly plausible explanation. Churches send foreign aid all the time. Volunteers, too. They're usually good people."
"No argument from me," Reacher said. "But my whole life has been about the people that aren't usual, the exceptions."
"Why are you so convinced?"
"The welding."
"Locks can be broken."
"The container was welded to the trailer, and that's not how containers get shipped. They get lifted off and put on boats, by cranes. That's the whole point of containers. The welding suggests they don't mean for that container to leave the country." Vaughn's phone rang. A 3-minute wait. From a cop's perspective, the upside of all the Homeland Security hoopla. Agencies talked, computers were linked, databases were shared. She answered and listened 4 long minutes. Then she thanked her caller and clicked off.
"Can't rule out the AWOL involvement," she said.
"Because?"
"They're listed as activists, and activists can be into all kinds of things."
"What kind of activists?"
"Religious conservatives."
"What kind?"
"They run something called the Church of the Apocalypse in L.A.
"The Apocalypse is a part of the end times story," Reacher said. Vaughn said nothing. Reacher said, "Maybe they came here to recruit Thurman as a brother activist. Maybe they recognized his special potential."
"They wouldn't have stayed in this hotel. They'd have been guests in his house."
"Not the first time." "He didn't know them yet. The second time, maybe. And the third, and the fourth. Maybe the fifth and the sixth. Depends how hard they had to work to convince him. There's a 4-month gap between their first visit and when he ordered the TNT from Kearney."
"He said that was a bureaucratic error."
"Did you believe him?" Vaughn didn't answer. 4 phone calls, Reacher said. "That's all it's going to take." They drove west to the edge of town. 3 miles away through the rainy darkness, they could see the plant's lights, faint and blue and distant, blurred by the rain on the windshield, a fragmented, sepulchral glow way out in the middle of nowhere, empty space all around it. They parked on a curb facing out of town, level with the last of the buildings. Reacher eased his butt off the seat and took the cell phone he had borrowed out of his pocket. Then he took out the sheet of paper he had taken from the purchasing office. The new cell phone numbers. The paper was wet and soggy, and he had to peel apart the folds very carefully. "Ready?" he asked. Vaughn said,
"I don't understand."
He dialed the third number down, heard ringtone in his ear, twice, 4 times, 6 times, 8. Then the call was answered. A muttered greeting in a voice he recognized. A man's voice, fairly normal in tone and timbre, but a little dazed and muffled twice, first by coming from a huge chest cavity and again by the cellular circuitry. "The big guy from the plant," Reacher said.
"How are you? Been awake long?"
The guy said.
"Go to hell."
"Maybe I will, maybe I won't. I'm not sure about the likelihood of things like that. You guys are the theologians, not me."
No reply. Reacher asked,
"Is your buddy awake, too?"
No reply.
Reacher said, "I'll call him and see for myself."
He clicked off and dialed the second number on the list. It rang 8 times, and the plant foreman answered. Reacher said,
"Sorry, wrong number."
He clicked off. Vaughn asked,
"What exactly are you doing?"
"How did the insurgents hurt David?"
"With a roadside bomb."
"Detonated, huh?"
"Remotely, I assume?"
Reacher nodded. "Probably by radio, from the nearest ridgeline. So if Thurman has built the bomb, how will he detonate it?"
"The same way?"
"But not from the nearest hill. He'll probably want a lot more distance than that. He'll probably want to be out of state somewhere. Maybe at home here in Colorado, or in his damn church, which would take a very powerful radio. In fact, he'd probably have to build one himself to be sure of reliability,
which is a lot of work.
So my guess is he decided to use one that someone else already built.
Someone like Verizon, or T-Mobile, or Singular."
"Cell phone?"
Reacher nodded again.
"It's the best way. The phone companies spend a lot of time and money building reliable networks. Look at their commercials. They're proud of the fact that you can call anywhere from anywhere. Some of them even give you free long distance."
"And the number is on that list?"
"It would make sense," Reacher said.
"Two things happened at the same time, 3 months ago. Thurman ordered 20 tons of TNT and 4 new cell phones. Sounds like a plan to me. He already had everything else he needed. My guess is he kept one phone for himself and gave 2 to his inner circle so they could have secure communications between themselves, separate from anything else they were doing. And my guess is the 4th phone is buried in the heart of that container, with the ringer wired to a primer circuit. The ringer on a cell phone puts out a decent little voltage. Maybe they fitted a standby battery, and maybe they connected an external antenna. Maybe one of those antennas on the Peterbilt was a cell antenna from Radio Shack, wired back to the trailer."
"And you're going to call that number?"
Reacher said, "Soon." He dialed the 1st number on the list. It rang, and then Thurman answered, fast and impatient, like he had been waiting for the call. Reacher asked,
"You guys over the wall yet?"
Thurman said,
"We're still here. Why are you calling us?"
"He's starting to see a pattern."
"The last phone was Underwood's. He's dead, so he won't answer. So there's no point calling it."
Reacher said,
"Okay. How long are you going to keep us here?"
"Just a minute more," Reacher said.
He clicked off and laid the phone on the Chevy's dash, stared out through the windshield. Vaughn said,
"You can't do this. It would be murder."
Reacher said,
"Live by the sword, die by the sword.
Thurman should know that quotation better than anyone. It's from the Bible. Matthew chapter 26, verse 52. Slightly paraphrased. Also, they have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. Hosea chapter 8, verse 7. I'm sick of people who claim to live by the scriptures, cherry-picking the parts they find convenient and ignoring all the rest."
"You could be completely wrong about him."
"Then there's no problem. Gifts don't explode. We've got nothing to lose."
but you might be right.
In which case he shouldn't have lied to me. He should have confessed. I would have let him take his chance in court.
I don't believe you.
We'll never know now.
He doesn't seem worried enough.
He's used to saying things and having people believe him. And he told me he's not afraid of dying. He told me he's going to a better place.
You're not a one-man justice department.
He's no better than whoever blew up David's Humvee. Worse, even. David was a combatant, at least. And out on the open road, Thurman is going to have that thing driven to a city somewhere, with children and old people all around. Thousands of them, and more thousands, maybe not quite close enough. He's going to put thousands more people in your situation. Vaughn said nothing. And for what? For some stupid, deluded fantasy. Vaughn said nothing. Reacher checked the final number, entered it into his phone, held the phone flat on his palm, and held it out to Vaughn. Your choice. Green button to make the call, red button to cancel it. Vaughn didn't move for a moment. Then she took her hand off the wheel, folded three fingers and her thumb, held her index finger out straight. It was small, neat, elegant, and damp, and it had a trimmed nail. She held it still, close to the phone's LED window. Then she moved it. She pressed the green button. Nothing happened. Not at first. Reacher wasn't surprised. He knew a little about cell phone technology. He had read a long article in a trade publication abandoned on an airplane. Press the green button, and the phone in your hand sends a request by radio to the nearest cell tower, called a base transceiver station by the people who put it there. The phone says, "Hey, I want to make a call." The base transceiver station forwards the plea to the nearest base station controller. By microwave, if the beam counters got their way during the planning phase, or by fiber optic cable if the engineers got theirs. The base station controller bundles all the near simultaneous requests it can find and moves them on to the closest mobile switching center, where the serious action starts. Maybe at this point a ringtone starts up in your earpiece, but it means nothing. It's a placebo. It's there to reassure you. So far, you're not even close to connected. The mobile switching center identifies the destination phone, checks if it's switched on, that it's not busy, that it's not set to call divert. Speech channels are limited in number, and therefore expensive to operate. You don't get near one unless there's a viable chance of an answer. If all is well, a speech channel clicks in. It extends first from your local mobile switching center to its distant opposite number. Maybe by fiber optics, maybe by microwave, maybe by satellite if the distance is great. Then the distant mobile switching center hits up its closest base station controller, which hits up its closest base transceiver station, which emits a radio blast to the phone you're looking for, an 850 megahertz or a 1.9 gigahertz pulse surfing on a perfect spherical wavefront close to the speed of light. A nanosecond later, the circuit is complete. The tone in your ear morphs from phony to real, and the target phone starts its urgent ringing. Total time lag? An average of 7 whole seconds. Vaughn took her finger back and stared forward out the windshield. The Chevy's engine was still running, and the wipers were still beating back and forth. The windshield smeared in perfect arcs. There was still a little protective wax on the glass. 2 seconds.
Nothing, Vaughn said.
Reacher said, wait. 4 seconds. 5. They stared into the distance, The blue arena lights hung and shimmered in the wet air, pale and misty, fractured by intervening raindrops like twinkling starlight. 6 seconds. 7. Then, the silent horizon, lit up with an immense white flash that filled the windshield and bloomed instantly higher and wider. The rain all around turned to steam as the air superheated, and jets of white vapor speared up and out in every direction like 100,000 rockets had launched simultaneously. The vapor was followed by a halo of black soot that punched instantly from a tight cap to a raging black hemisphere 1 mile high and 1 mile wide. It rolled and tore and folded back on itself and was pierced by violent trails of steam as supersonic white-hot shrapnel flung through it at more than 15,000 miles an hour. No sound. Not then. Just blinding light and silence. In still air, the sound would have taken 14 seconds to arrive from 3 miles away. But the air wasn't still. It was moving fast, in a massive compression wave. The wave carried the sound with it. It arrived 3 seconds after the light. The truck rocked back against the brake, and the air roared with the rolling violence of the explosion. First, a crisp, deafening crump, and then a banshee screaming from the shrapnel in the air, and another worldly pelting sound as 1 million blasted fragments obliterated everything in their path and fell to earth and tore up the scrub and boiled and hissed where they lay. Then the decompression wave blew in the other way as air rushed back to fill the vacuum, and the truck rocked again, and the black cloud was pulverized to nothing by the violent wind, and then there was nothing to see except tongues of random flame and spouts of drifting steam, and nothing to hear except the steady patter of shrapnel falling back to earth from 3 miles up. And after 10 long seconds, there was not even that, just the patient rain on the Chevy's roof. Chapter 73. Vaughn called out the whole of the Hope PD for crowd control. Within 30 minutes, she had all four of her deputies and her brother officer and her watch commander and the desk guy all lined up on the western edge of Despair's last block. Nobody was allowed through. The state cops showed up next. Within an hour, they had 3 cars there. 5 more showed up within the next 4 hours. They had taken the long way around. Everyone knew there had been uranium at the plant. The state cops confirmed that the MPs had the road blocked to the west on a 5-mile perimeter. It was close to dawn, and they were already stopping incoming trucks. Dawn came, and the rain finally stopped, and the sky turned hard blue, and the air turned crystal clear. Like nerves after pain, Reacher had read once in a poem. The morning was too cool to raise steam off the soaked ground. The mountains looked 1,000 miles away, but every detail was visible. Their rocky outcrops, their pine forests, their tree lines, their snow channels. Reacher borrowed a pair of binoculars from Vaughn's watch commander and climbed to the 3rd floor of the last building to the west. He struggled with a jammed window and crouched and put his elbows on the sill and focused into the distance. Not much to see. The white metal wall was gone. Just a few rags and tatters of shredded metal remained, blown and tumbled hundreds of yards in every direction. The plant itself was mostly a black, smoking pit, with cranes and gantries knocked over and smashed and bent. Crushers had been toppled off their concrete pads. Anything smaller had been smashed to pieces too small to reliably identify. The office buildings were gone entirely. Thurman's residential compound had been obliterated.
The house had been smashed to matchwood. The fieldstone wall was a horizontal rock field spread south and west like grains of spilled salt on a table. The plantings were all gone. Occasional foot-high stumps were all that was left of the trees. The airplane barn had been demolished. No sign of the Piper. Immense damage. Better here than somewhere else, Richa thought. He came downstairs to a changed situation. Federal agencies had arrived. Gossip was flowing. Air Force radar in Colorado Springs had detected metal 15,000 feet up. It had hung there for a long second before falling back to Earth. Radiation-sniffing drone planes had been dispatched and were closing in on wide, circular paths. The rain was seen as a mercy. DU dust was believed to be strongly hygroscopic. Nothing bad would drift. Every contractor within 100 miles in Colorado and Nebraska and Kansas had been contacted. A hurricane fence nearly 19 miles long was needed. The site was going to be fenced off forever on a 3-mile radius. The fence was going to be hung with biohazard signs every 6 feet. The agencies already owned the signs, but not the wire. No hard information was volunteered by the townsfolk. No hard questions were asked by the agencies. The word on everyone's lips was accident. An accident at the plant. It was second nature, a part of the hardscrabble culture. An accident at the mill. An accident at the mine. Consistent with history. If the agencies had doubts, they knew better than to voice them. The Pentagon had begun to stonewall even before the last fragments had cooled. State officials arrived with contingency plans. Food and water was to be trucked in. Buses were to be laid on for job searches in neighboring towns. Special welfare would be provided for the first 6 months. Transitional help of every kind would be afforded. After that, any stragglers would be strictly on their own. First Reacher and then Vaughn were pushed steadily east by the official activity. By the middle of the afternoon, they were sitting together in the Chevy outside the dry goods store, with nothing more to do. They took one last look to the west and then set off down the road toward Hope. They went to Vaughn's house and showered and dressed again. Vaughn said,
"David's hospital is going to fold."
"Someone else will step in," Reacher said. "Someone better."
"I'm not going to abandon him."
"I don't think you should."
"Even though he won't know."
"He knew beforehand, and it was important to him."
"You think so?"
"I know so. I know soldiers."
Reacher took the borrowed phone out of his pocket and dropped it on the bed, followed it with the registration from the old Suburban's glove box, asked Vaughn to mail both things back with no return address on the package. She said,
"That sounds like the start of a farewell speech."
"It is," Reacher said. "And the middle and the end." They hugged a little formally, like two strangers who shared many secrets. Then Reacher left. He walked down her winding path and walked 4 blocks north to First Street. He got a ride very easily. A stream of vehicles was heading east, emergency workers, journalists, men in suits in plain sedans, contractors. The excitement had made them friendly. There was a real community spirit. Reacher rode with a post-hole digger from Kansas who had signed up to dig some of the 16,000 holes necessary for the new fence. The guy was cheerful. He was looking at months of steady work. Reacher got out in Sharon Springs, where there was a good road south. He figured San Diego was about 1,000 miles away, or more, if he followed some detours.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Gone Tomorrow, book 13 in the Jack Reacher series, free.
This is Dick Hill. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Nothing to Lose by Lee Child. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2008 by Lee Child. Production copyright 2008, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
And now, a free preview of Gone Tomorrow, book 13 in the Jack Reacher series.
Suicide bombers are easy to spot. They give out all kinds of telltale signs, mostly because they're nervous. By definition, they're all first-timers. Israeli counterintelligence wrote the defensive playbook. They told us what to look for. They used pragmatic observation and psychological insight and came up with a list of behavioral indicators. I learned the list from an Israeli army captain 20 years ago. He swore by it. Therefore, I swore by it, too, because at the time I was on 3 weeks detached duty, mostly about a yard from his shoulder, in Israel itself, in Jerusalem, on the West Bank, in Lebanon, sometimes in Syria, sometimes in Jordan, on buses, in stores, on crowded sidewalks. I kept my eyes moving and my mind running free down the bullet points. 20 years later, I still know the list, and my eyes still move. Pure habit. From another bunch of guys, I learned another mantra. Look, don't see. Listen, don't hear. The more you engage, the longer you survive. The list is 12 points long if you're looking at a male suspect, 11 if you're looking at a woman. The difference is a fresh shave. Male bombers take off their beards. It helps them blend in, makes them less suspicious. The result is paler skin on the lower half of the face, no recent exposure to the sun. But I wasn't interested in shaves. I was working on the 11-point list. I was looking at a woman. I was riding the subway in New York City, the 6th train, the Lexington Avenue local, heading uptown 2 o'clock in the morning. I had gotten on at Bleecker Street from the south end of the platform into a car that was empty except for 5 people. Subway cars feel small and intimate when they're full. When they're empty, they feel vast and cavernous and lonely. At night, their lights feel hotter and brighter, even though they're the same lights they use in the day. They're all the lights there are. I was sprawled on a 2-person bench north of the end doors on the track side of the car. The other 5 passengers were all south of me on the long bench seats, in profile, side on, far from each other, staring blankly across the width of the car, 3 on the left and 2 on the right. The car's number was 7622. I once rode 8 stops on the 6 train next to a crazy person who talked about the car we were in with the same kind of enthusiasm that most men reserve for sports or women. Therefore, I knew that car number 7622 was an R142A model, the newest on the New York system, built by Kawasaki in Kobe, Japan, shipped over, trucked to the 207th Street yards, craned onto the tracks, towed down to 180th Street, and tested. I knew it could run 200,000 miles without major attention. I knew its automated announcement system gave instructions in a man's voice and information in a woman's, which was claimed to be a coincidence, but was really because the transportation chiefs believed such a division of labor was psychologically compelling. I knew the voices came from Bloomberg TV, but years before Mike became mayor. I knew there were 600 R-142As on the tracks, and that each one was a fraction over 51 feet long and a little more than 8 feet wide. I knew that the no-cab unit, like we had been in then, and I was in now, had been designed to carry a maximum of 40 people seated and up to 148 standing.
The crazy person had been clear on all that data. I could see for myself that the car's seats were blue plastic, the same shade as a late summer sky or a British Air Force uniform.